Welcome to Onc Live On Air. In today's episode, we spoke with Scott Coppetz, MD, PhD, FACP, about the use of circulating tumor DNA in patients with colorectal cancer. In our conversation, Dr. Coppetz discussed the high positive predictive value of ctDNA assays, which indicate disease presence when positive. He emphasized clinical trials that have shown strong prognostic implications with this type of assay, as well as study findings that demonstrated that ctDNA results could reduce chemotherapy use without compromising efficacy. Additionally, he noted the potential significance of ongoing trials that are exploring the use of ctDNA to guide therapy. Overall, he explained that ctDNA testing is becoming a standard in practice for colorectal cancer.
My name is Scott Coppetz, professor of GI medical oncology at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Here today on Onc Live to share some updates on how we're thinking about circulating tumor DNA in GI cancers, discuss some of the supporting evidence, and really dive into some of the practicalities on application. So, you know, circulating tumor DNA, we know, is used for a number of genotyping, understanding KRAS, BRAF, NRAS, for example, in colorectal cancer, as well as minimal residual disease testing. And these are two different applications with the different assays now that we're utilizing. So the discussion today is really going to be focused on minimal residual disease detection in colorectal cancer. And we've had a number of studies that have really started to explain the applications here and the utility. What we can say is we have a number of clinical trials, observational cohorts that have demonstrated the really strong prognostic implications of ctDNA to the point that many of these assays have very high positive predictive value, meaning when we see positive results, we know that the patient has disease that remains. The sensitivity of these assays are such that sometimes we can still get negative ctDNA tests, even though there can be microscopic disease that remains over time. So these studies, big ones being the GALAXY study out of Japan, the BESPOKE study in the U.S., INTERCEPT cohort here from MD Anderson as well, have reproducibly demonstrated the incredible prognostic information. And the key is many of these patients, almost all of them, will recur in the absence of some intervention. And if it's post-adjuvant, then the vast majority of these patients eventually will have radiographic disease that appears. The clinical trials in this space, the first series, the dynamic series of studies looking at in stage two, asking questions about appropriate escalation or de-escalation of therapy in a setting that we've struggled with how to best optimize use of chemotherapy. And the dynamic study, initial one, demonstrating that the efficacies were similar when one uses ctDNA, but you used 45% less chemotherapy, right? And this idea that you could better deliver the chemotherapy to the patients that needed it. And we had data in stage three, the dynamic three that was reported out, again, showing strongly prognostic information, but did acknowledge that escalating, so going beyond a kind of a standard FOLFOX regimen, for example, to add in irinotecan, didn't appear to have substantial benefit, but really reiterating the fact that these are assays that can provide substantial value. There are studies ongoing, Circulate North America study, for example, that's now asking the question that randomized studies in a larger series, can you escalate up intensification of therapy, or can you de-escalate a stage three, right? We know that some stage threes do really well and have very low recurrence risks. So can you do serial ctDNA monitoring and only use adjuvant chemotherapy if you detect evidence of disease by ctDNA? So how do we use this currently? Here, we're typically testing with a tumor-informed ctDNA test, and then using this both in post-operative setting to help understand and guide risk discussion and prognosis. And in stage two patients, it really has been critical component to think about, this decision-making with adjuvant therapy. In stage three we are enrolling into clinical trials, really not clear how to use that immediate post-op value to drive adjuvant therapy yet. But in practicalities, outside of a trial, you know, somebody that we're thinking about 3 months, we may do 6 months. Again, are we providing benefit? We don't quite know yet. And then in monitoring after adjuvant therapy, we'll continue to watch patients if they're positive. There are a number of clinical trials that patients can go on with novel immunotherapy, vaccine strategies, others that are ongoing there, as well as trying to think about how to deploy targeted therapies and ADCs in this space that are coming. So there's a clearinghouse of those, crcmrd.org, the website with patient advocates we put together to really help direct patients to those settings. Now, the question is, how do you interpret these results? And the assays vary, but the key component is there something detectable? And for example, a lot of these tumor-informed assays, if there's something detectable, it's positive. And the absolute level may not matter that much in our interpretation of whether or not there's disease that remains. And same for some of the other assays that are just, you know, detected or not detected. So I really think about this as a binomial readout that is really kind of a positive or negative. So it great tools. We're still learning how to use it, but I think are right now bringing a lot of value to patients in colorectal cancer. And I think we're learning more about gastric and pancreatic cancer, and that will be following, and I'm sure we'll see more of that data here in the near future as well. When we're thinking about implementing ctDNA testing, there's a lot of practicalities between these great studies that we see published and presented and the reality of actually implementing them in clinic. And one of the first questions that always comes up is, how do you integrate that? And how do you have these conversations with patients? And then what assays do we use? So the first is, you know, we have the data certainly and the reimbursement patterns for colorectal cancer. So we'll talk about this in the context of colorectal. I think a lot of these are going to be applied to other tumor types as well. So, you know, understanding the platform, and I would say kind of, you know, picking a test that you're comfortable with and getting used to that workflow. I think there's a lot of increasing number of tests out there, some that are I've been in the clinic for many years and performed well. There are newer ones that are coming. And one of the questions is a tumor-informed versus a tumor-agnostic or tumor-naive. Now, they have their strengths and weaknesses. The tumor-informed platforms have the most clinical data. These borrow their strength from the fact that you're looking at the fingerprint of the tumor that's resected and looking for those signatures. And that avoids a lot of concerns like, you know, that there can be mutations found in aging white blood cells, for example, in all of us, even in those of us who are not that old, like me, right? But, you know, sure enough, we can find those aging white cells there. And so the reality is that having those tumor-informed, make sure that what you're detecting really is coming from the tumor, not anywhere else. But there's trade-offs. One of them is the turnaround time. Like it takes 4, maybe 5 weeks to get these results because you have to sequence the tumor itself, pick out the probes, and then run it on the assay as opposed to a tumor naive that can just go right into the sequencing. But we have data now that says, you know, after about 2 weeks after surgery, it's a good time to check. And we will commonly do that testing at that time period of approximately, you know, 2 to 4 weeks after surgery, such that we'll have that result back at kind of that 6 to 8 week time point if we're going to be using it in those conversations with the patients. Some will actually develop and test preoperatively as well, with the idea that if a tumor for whatever reason is a low shedding or a non-shedding in the pre-op setting, that you know you can that can help guide the interpretation. It's a little bit of a nuance. The advantage there is that process gets going sooner than the post-op testing becomes a you know, a 7-day turnaround as opposed to the longer one. We are seeing changes from a whole exome to a whole genome platforms. And so there are evolving tests to improve sensitivity here. But the key is to ensure that it's an assay that really has that very high positive predictive value. Like, we want to be able to trust that result to say if it's positive, it's real then as well. Now, reimbursement for colorectal cancer, fortunate that, you know, Medicare coverage has been established. Many insurances are following along. And I think a lot of companies have very flexible policies when it comes to billing. And so, you know, that's a good discussion to have with your testing, you know, company to make sure that that those are in place. One of the other really important things are to, you know, before one dives into this, thinking about, you know, how do you have that conversation with the patient? In our practice, 95% of patients, you know, want and see value out of this information, and we're doing this routinely. However, there are some patients who just prefer not to know. And so I think this is something that should be discussed with the patient to understand how we would use the test, how we would alter the recommendations that we're giving to the patient then as well. So I think that's an important step there. And that's one of the key questions that comes up when, you know, when we, among our colleagues, like, how do we actually utilize this for managing and how do we think about when to utilize it? And this is an area where it's emerging. We don't have that full level one data yet, but we can say it's incredibly prognostic. And so I think, you know, thinking through this and recognizing that this testing may not be for everyone, but for many patients, they can find value. So hopefully this is helpful and really reflects the realities of testing ctDNA in clinic. So the use of ctDNA testing for minimal residual disease has continued to evolve. And while we had discussed that the ctDNA testing data has a number of studies about how to utilize better adjuvant therapy, you know, how we best deploy 5-FU and oxaliplatin, the real future is, you know, how can we do this to further improve outcomes? And I think this is, I firmly believe, is going to be transformational. This is where we're going to look back 5-10 years from now and say, this is how we substantially improved outcomes for patients. And I, and certainly that's the hope and promise of this this space. So there are questions about, okay, how, what are the strategies we can do to use ctDNA to better guide therapies moving forward? I'll highlight a few. Some of them are thinking about how do you improve out the current adjuvant therapy? How do you take current FOLFOX, Xelox, CAPOX, make it better? There is a study that's completed enrollment that's a personalized mRNA vaccine by BioNTech. And the idea here is to try to understand, after completion of the cytotoxic chemotherapy, is there value of using the vaccine in patients who are ctDNA positive? So this is a perfect example of thinking about how you can escalate up the intensity of adjuvant therapy. So here, patients positive going after surgery, they go on to receive adjuvant therapy. And then regardless of the impact of adjuvant therapy on ctDNA, they go ahead and they proceed on to the vaccine. There are other strategies that are looking at how do you utilize therapies after adjuvant therapy. So a number of clinical trials, they're asking questions about, well, what about other IO therapies? And I really think this is a space that IO can make a difference. When we think about why immunotherapy doesn't work in many solid tumors, it's because there is a really profound hostile microenvironment that's established as the tumor develops this bulky metastatic disease. And by the time we see it radiographically, there are dozens of immunosuppressive barriers that are in place, including hypoxic environment, fibrotic tissues, a polarization of the macrophages, MDSCs, Tregs that have appeared. And when you look back, and we've now done this, looking at really microscopic deposits of disease that are beyond what we can see radiographically. But for example, when we do a partial hepatectomy for a visible lesion, we find really small submillimeter lesions elsewhere in the liver that we can then profile. It turns out that those are pretty immunologically active tumors. You see a lot of infiltrating T cells, you don't have a lot of Tregs, you don't have the fibrosis, hypoxic adenosine signaling. So all of those barriers that we would think about are really have been knocked down. And so that's the enthusiasm that one has and the field has about thinking about bringing immunotherapy into the setting where the tumor is the most vulnerable, where there's already an immune response that's present that we just need to further bolster. So stay tuned on that. If you want to follow along on some of those, as I mentioned, the website crcmrd.org is a kind of a clearinghouse of all of these, immunotherapy and other type of studies going on in the MRD setting. We also can utilize ctDNA, and I think there's a lot of interest to think about how do we use this to understand who's going to respond to adjuvant therapy or not. So very nice data out of the GALAXY study. It's been replicated in other settings that said, if you look halfway through adjuvant therapy and if a patient has ctDNA before starting adjuvant therapy and then you're halfway through 3 months, if that ctDNA has not cleared, that the patient that is not going to be cured with the adjuvant therapy, right? So that's a really profound time point where you can say, okay, maybe we need to start to think differently. And it's not just finishing up another 3 months of FOLFOX, but how do we then change gears at that point? This is still experimental. We're not always routinely testing partway through adjuvant therapy in our practice yet. And so not using it fully, but this is kind of, I think, where we may be going is another opportunity to intervene. The other current applications of it, and I think will be emerging even further, is thinking about how do you use this to modulate the intensity of your imaging, right? It may be if you're serially ctDNA negative after surgery, you don't need imaging every 4 or 6, 9 months, like we may do after resection of a liver met, for example, that maybe we can extend out the intervals. And likewise, if you're positive, maybe those are the patients that do need every 3 month imaging to really monitor and try to catch recurrence earlier. So those are areas where some people are utilizing that and changing practice in that way. And I think we'll see more studies coming in this space. But I'd say overall, getting comfortable with ctDNA. This is not something that is a passing fad. The data is emerging. We're going to learn more how to do this. And I think for those patients that are really engaged in those practices that want to be kind of cutting edge and thinking about how to utilize this, both kind of thinking about it in these settings like stage 2 colon cancer, but also what do you do? How can you get patients referred on to clinical trials where we may have that additional window of cure if we can find the right immunotherapy? So I think getting comfortable with these and having these conversations with patients is critical in the current environment. Well, hopefully I've shared with you some of the excitement and enthusiasm. We kind of talked about the applications currently, what the supporting evidence is, some best practices, practical considerations about how to implement ctDNA testing in your clinic now, and then really a bit about where we think the field is going and why there's such enthusiasm about using this MRD window to really improve outcomes for patients and hopefully cure more patients at the end of the day. So for those of you who have some experience or are dipping your toes into this space, I would say it is a good time to get some experience, to understand this, start having these conversations with patients about who would benefit and how you could utilize some of these therapies. So I would say don't be afraid. There are a lot of assays out there, and which assay you pick is probably not as critical as just getting some of that experience and being able to interpret the results that are coming. I think the kind of the more definitive applications of these, where it goes from you can do this testing to then it becomes a mandatory part of clinical practice. We're not there yet, but I think what is between us and that is really the readout of some of these studies like Circulate North America, which will be a really definitive, large study about how to best guide adjuvant therapy. And then some of these novel therapies like the BioNTech study that I mentioned, where we're thinking about using these vaccines to try to improve outcomes. And if something like that can show benefit for patients, then I think that really opens up the applications of ctDNA and where we'll see the ctDNA becoming increasingly incorporated into standard of care clinical practice guidelines. So hopefully a good overview. It's a rapidly moving field, and I'm sure we'll have opportunities to share updates in this space as the science evolves.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.